napkin and wipe the sweat off my forehead. Jeez Louise. You could have took a little bit more time, Sam, please. I am Daryl, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Daryl.
And start off by apologizing for being late. It's still in me. My dad told me growing up that I'd be late for my own funeral, so I'm hoping that's right. But I'm going to start off. My sobriety date is January 9th, 2015. And I do have a sponsor, and he's in the room. I have a home group, which meets at Lignum on Tuesday nights at 7 o'clock at the Raritan Club. I do have a service position, which is making the coffee and leading the meeting, chairing the meeting at the Remington Out-of-Towners Group, which meets on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock in Remington at the Baptist Church. And you got to excuse me, I'm a little nervous right now. You know, I was thinking about that phrase that somebody coined, the egomaniac with the inferiority complex, and I swear they were living inside my head when they coined that, because, you know, I used to sit back and listen to guys up here at the mic and be like, man, if I could just get up there, I would tell them a really good story. And I'm up here and I'm like shaking in my freaking shoes right now. But man, it's good to see such a beautiful group of people in here tonight, man. And a lot of people that were very close are still very close to me. I helped save my life in this room tonight. I'm going to start off by telling a little bit about myself and how it was growing up. And I don't know if anybody can relate to any of this, but I'm going to do my best. I mean, I was the oldest brother. Let me start off. I have four siblings in the family. I have an older sister, and I'm the oldest brother of my two younger brothers. And I was born military, born in San Antonio, Texas, at Lackland Air Force Base. And we moved around a lot when we were kids. It was hard to really get established anywhere, you know, with a group of friends, because it was always I was here and then I was there. And, you know, I didn't realize along the way, but this is, you know, part of the way I seen things was how this was going on in my life and how I started to develop an attitude towards my father and my mother for what was going on. And so anyway, my mother and father, I never really seen them drink growing up, especially my mother. I never seen her drink. My father, I said the first time I seen him drink was, I believe I was 12 years old. It was New Year's Eve, and he had a little too much to drink and wound up on the couch, and I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. You know, I thought, because I seen other kids' dads that I thought were cool people, you know, getting loaded all the time, and I was just always kind of attracted to that kind of thing. And, you know, I seen my dad doing that, and I was like, wow, maybe my dad is cool, you know. But, yeah, growing up, I mean, it was, you know, my father was military, so he was pretty strict, and I was one of those guys that, thank you, Matt. I was one of those guys that, you know, was oppositional, so when he told me to do something, I would do the opposite. And so from a young age, I was getting in trouble. I remember being, I believe I was six, and we were back in Texas after living in Germany. We were back in Texas and in Lubbock, and I was on the base, and I got to hanging out with some older kids, because that seemed to be a routine in my life, was to gravitate towards the older ones that I thought were cool and doing cool things. And I was hanging out with this guy, and next thing you know, he told me it'd be a good idea to throw some pears off the pear tree over the wall. Well, I didn't put everything two and two together at the time, but I was throwing pears off the pear tree over the wall into 55-mile-an-hour traffic. And next thing you know, I was just having a good old time, and I hear stuff going on outside the wall. I just didn't think it was no big deal until the MPs came and picked me up and took me back home. And, you know, that didn't blow over so well. You know, through the years, I watched my father grow as a man. And, you know, at that point in time, I used to get whippings as a boy. I mean, that's just how it was when I was growing up. You did bad, you know, you got a whooping. And I remember the first time I seen one of those commercials on the TV. you know, that hotline that you could call. I used to try to threaten them with that, and they said, well, we're going to give them a reason to be here when they get here. Go on and call them. And, you know, well, anyway, you know, that was the beginning of a pattern that went on in my life. And, you know, I remember we moved back to Germany, and my mom's mother, my Oma, who's passed on now, was a big influence in my life. And she was a real strong woman, and she was always family-oriented, and she kind of tried to instill that in us. And my grandfather, he was military as well, and he had retired and was living overseas in Germany while we were living there, so that way we could be together as a family. And my Oma, she took us all around Germany, and we experienced all the different things in the culture, going to the different castles and taking cruises on the Rhine River, and you know, all this stuff that I kind of really took it. You know, I didn't see it the way that I see it now when I was a kid. You know, I just kind of thought it was no big deal. You know what I mean? Like, I was entitled to this. Like, I'm living in Germany. This is, you know, this is what you're supposed to do. And I look back on it now, it's like, man, what a privilege to be able to see that part of the world. You know, some people don't leave the town of Culpeper, you know. And so anyway, we moved from Germany, and I remember we got the news that we were moving to Maryland. And I thought we were moving to the big old city of Washington, D.C. This was my perception at the time. I was going into fifth grade, and we had to move during the summer. And I remember looking at my dad and telling him, well, you're going to have to get me an assault rifle to go to school. You know, because I was reading all these things in the paper, and I had this idea of what it was going to be like to go to school in Washington, D.C. Well, it didn't end up happening anything like that. We moved to the suburbs over in Waldorf, Maryland. And I remember starting school there and trying to get affiliated with a new group of kids once again. And I remember being there, and, you know, the way I see it now is different, but I remember this boy I played soccer with in Germany, and his name was Gabriel. And we're in temporary housing waiting to get a house, and I seen this boy Gabriel on the playground. He had left a few months before me from Germany. I didn't know where he went. You know, it was just like, you have friends and they're gone. You know, that's just how it was. And I remember seeing this boy, and I was like, wow, that's the coolest thing in the world. I was with you in Germany, so we kind of got to hanging out a little bit. Next thing you know, poof, he was gone again. And I went through fifth grade, and in sixth grade, we moved, and Dad bought a house. And, you know, I grew up, I was used to living in the apartments, you know, on base housing. And, you know, so this is the first time I got established in a neighborhood, so I'm like, looking around, like, what's there to do and all this stuff. And remember one of my first days back in sixth grade, I went to school and there was Gabriel in my art class. I was like, wow, how cool is that? And, you know, the next thing you know, he was gone again, but I ended up staying. And so I remember being in middle school, and this is kind of how it went down. I remember always getting praised for being an intelligent being, you know, from kindergarten through fifth grade into sixth grade. You know, I really excelled in school. I was in advanced learning classes. You know, I was ahead of some of the other kids. And I remember I went into class one day, and I sat down and I took a look around, and I just decided I didn't belong there. You know, that's not where the cool kids are at, you know. And I think somehow it kind of changed when I started hanging out with certain kids in the neighborhood and seeing what they were doing and you know, how they were living and everything else. And, like, I always kind of, like, chased excitement in my life, you know. And these kids, you know, they were into extreme sports like skateboarding and biking, and they weren't into coming home and doing their homework. You know, and I've got to take advantage when I was younger because Dad was gone a lot, and Mom was the biggest enabler, I come to find out. I learned how to manipulate her at a young age. I remember I was, let's see here, I think it was 13, and I convinced her that, you know, she's going to need to buy me cigarettes or I'm going to be at the store stealing them. And she'd rather see her son had the cigarettes than get a risk of him going to the store and stealing them, because I think she figured out at that time that with all my brothers and sisters, I mean, she couldn't control me. You know, I was full of anger. You know, when I didn't get my way, I throw a fit, and that's how it was. And, you know, I can still be that way today, but anyway, won't get into that. But I remember drugs are a big part of my story. I'm not going to try to, you know, get into that too much, but it is a big part of my story. It was hard for me to identify as an alcoholic when I got here. I remember the first experience I had with a mind-altering, judgment-impairing chemical, as my sponsor calls them. I was in sixth grade, and I remember being on the railroad tracks, and these boys had some green stuff and rolled it up, and, you know, I couldn't wait to find out what this was going to do to me. You know, I had heard all about it. I watched the commercials on TV. This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. And I didn't care. And I was different. You know what I mean? Like, that wasn't going to happen to me. And first time I did it, really didn't do much to me. You know? But it was the second time. I really remember that second time. And I remember I passed out at an old bank that was beginning to be tore down, and I remember the kids riding around me on their bikes, and they were laughing because I was throwing up, and I was, you know, I couldn't get it together. I was this way and that way, and I remember getting home, and I had some of that funny green stuff in my pocket, and, you know, I just rolled up in the driveway, threw the bike down the middle of the driveway, and kind of stumbled into the house and went to bed. I mean, you know, I couldn't handle what was going on. And I remember waking up to my sister in there, because she was always the one that would, you know, snitch me out. And he was acting funny, and then this, and Dad's going through my stuff, and I don't have enough energy to stop anything that's going on. And he finds it, and he's like, you know, yelling at me that I'm getting my booty whooped. And then it's, you know, and then it was, my thought was, boy, that was fun. You know what I mean? And then my perception of life and what I wanted to do and everything else kind of changed at that point. It became magnetized towards having fun, is what I thought was fun. You know, my new fun that I found. And hanging out with some of these kids that were really getting it on, you know. And, you know, it just kind of slowly progressed. You know, I was one of those Ritalin kids, you know, so that... you know, was a crutch that I kind of used when I was a kid. You know, I found out how to manipulate that when I would act up and act out in school. I'd just tell them I didn't take my medication. You know what I mean? Then I had mom in the back pocket. Anything's going on, she's coming to the superintendent meeting with me. She's coming here. She's going there. You know, because I'm her baby. You know what I mean? She's trying to protect her baby in any way possible. And you know, man. Well, anyway, I remember I believe it was the summer in between eighth grade and high school was my first experience with alcohol, and that I can truly remember. I think I had tasted beer before in the woods. You know, we were camping, and we kind of stole a beer, and it was like, you know, I was like, man, that stuff tastes like crap. Why do they even drink that? And, well, anyway, my first experience with alcohol was... I was hanging out with the cool kids, and we had got done skateboarding that day, and come to find out the older kid, Nicky, was throwing a party, and he was cool because he lived at a house that his dad owned, and his older brother worked and paid the bills there, and he was able to live there with his older brother, and his older brother was of age to drink, and he would buy anybody that came over alcohol. And I remember going over there, and, man, there was a lot going on. You know what I mean? I mean, there was... girls getting crazy over here, and guys doing this over here, and I remember being down there playing pool, and I see, you know, this bottle of 99 bananas gets broke out, and I'm like, just watching these people beer bong this stuff, right? And I'm like, I can do that, right? So next thing you know, I'm got the beer bong full of 99 bananas, and I remember that stuff went down, and about 2 minutes later, that stuff came back up. man, the world, I mean, it was like I got dizzy and, you know, all this stuff was going on. And I remember I started to get sick. You know, I was having a good time. I mean, that's what I told myself. And being out in the, I thought I was fitting in at this point, you know what I mean? Like, they wanted to hang out with me. Like, they invited me over for this party. And, like, I'm cool now. And I get in there, and we're in the garage, and I'm so wasted. And I never experienced it before. And they're all used to, you know, getting drunk and everything else. And I'm leaned up against the wall. Next thing you know, I feel this hot stuff on my leg. And I'm like, what's going on? Well, they had sprayed lighter fluid on the floor and thought it'd be funny to spray it up my leg. And so I'm, first time getting drunk, I'm on fire. I got nylon pants on, jogging pants on. And, like, I'm trying to put it out by whiffing it, you know, like kicking my leg around. And somebody tells me, stop, drop, and roll. And I'm like, oh, that's right. That's what I'm supposed to do. So, anyway, that was my first experience with alcohol. And I remember the next day when I woke up with a headache. And I woke up in that musty basement, man. And, I mean, there was beer cans everywhere and all this and that. And I was just like, man, that was some good stuff right there, man. Like, it was good quality fun. These people really care about me, you know what I mean? Like, light me on fire. And anyway. So, I mean, I experimented with a lot of different stuff in high school. From the little pieces of little sugar cubes with drops of stuff on them and pieces of paper that make you see funny and, you know, all that. And anyway, I remember at that time during high school, it just seemed to kind of progress a little bit. I figured out that if I took more of my medication than what was prescribed to me, it would do a different effect to me. I turned all my buddies onto that. You know, I remember every chance I got, I was looking for the party. That's just the way it went. You know what I mean? Like, if I could sneak out on a Tuesday night and we can go out and get loaded all night long, that's what I did. And I remember one time, this was followed by getting my butt whipped, but I come out of my, I was on the second story, and we had this, like, makeshift kind of balcony cover on the back, and it had, like, this fiberglass top to it. And I remember opening the window. I thought everybody was asleep. And I remember opening the window, and I come creaking across that thing, and my foot went through it. Right. So I got, I'm stuck at this point. And I'm hollering and hollering, and I'm thinking one of my brothers is going to come out and save me, but no, it was Dad. And that didn't end so well. But anyway, I made it through, you know, high school. I moved to Culpeper my senior year of high school. This is where another part of my resentment came in towards my family. It was, you know, I went from 6th grade to 11th grade with these kids, middle school and high school. Like, I'm with my graduating class, you know. Like, I've got to know these kids. Like, I got friends. Like, you know, I cared about certain people, and I got uprooted. You know, my senior year of high school, I moved from the suburbs of Maryland down here to Culpeper, and I come to school, and there was kids wearing overalls and bibs, and I mean, I wasn't used to that. I mean, to be honest, like, I was in that mentality, I'm either a skateboarder or I'm a gangster rapper. I mean, that's just the way it was. And we didn't have a whole lot of that bibs and that kind of stuff, you know, where I went to school. And you know, I seen my dad wearing them and stuff, but, you know, it wasn't the cool kids they were wearing in school. So anyway, I get down here to Culpeper, and I started school in Culpeper, and I had to get affiliated with all these new kids. So, of course, me having the mind that I got and the secret that I got, I find the ones that are doing what I was doing back home. And it didn't take too long. You know, my mom and dad were always in my corner. I remember my senior year, I was getting my license, and I had a learner's from Maryland. So mom would drive me. Instead of doing all the stuff to switch over to Virginia and go through the whole process again, she would drive me every day after school from Virginia to Maryland, go to driving school, and drive me back. And you know, that was something, honestly, at that point in time, I was entitled to that. You know what I mean? You pulled me out of Maryland and brought me down here, so you're going to take me to driving school. I mean, that's the way I thought. And, you know, it wasn't long ago that I had a conversation with her, and I thanked her for that, man, because, you know, my perspective's kind of changed on, you know, she didn't have to do that for a guy like me, you know. But anyway, so I make it through high school. I graduate. I got introduced to heavier and heavier drugs and more partying. I got introduced to doing the line of work that I do now, which a lot of people know, tree work. And I remember coming out of high school, I used to want to go to college. I used to want to do this. I used to want to do that. And I had a buddy that lived down the street, and he was making a certain amount of money a day, and he was getting paid cash money. And I said, well, that's what I need to keep doing what I'm doing, so I'm going to get a job doing that. And that's what I did. And, you know, I got hooked up with some guys. So anyway, fast forward a little bit. I moved back from Culpeper to Maryland because I had been seeing this girl that was a childhood friend of mine, and we were together for a little while, and she ended up getting pregnant, okay? So growing up, I always told myself, when I have a family, when this happens to me, I'm going to calm down, I'm going to grow up, and I'm going to take care of what's mine. And I had every intention of doing that. And long story short, it didn't happen that way. My daughter was born on June 23rd, 2005, and my birthday is June 25th. So I turned 21 in the hospital changing diapers. And I remember every chance I got, I was outside catching the bus. You know what I mean? I was there, so I looked at it as, well, at least I'm here. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, but I gotta catch a buzz. Because I remember going to the doctor with her. She had to go to a special doctor up in Bethesda. And I remember driving around the Beltway, driving with one knee, rolling up something. And she's like, what are you doing? You got your child's life, my life, and your life in your hands right now with your knee on the wheel, going 70 miles an hour. I said, well, I got to get right before I go to the doctors with you. You know what I mean? Like, I always had to have something to you know, face life as it's going on. And so anyway, long story short on that, 3 months after my daughter was born, I just couldn't seem to perform like normal dads would perform and come home and act right. And, you know, my daughter's mother happened to be a very spiritual person and very in tune with herself and decided that she couldn't live like that, and she left. And, you know, that was kind of the beginning of another downfall, you know. It was, look what I did. I'm a failure, you know. This is where this kind of self-talk started coming in. And I remember she left, and I remember all I could do was drink and drug. Get up, go to work, and drink and drug. And I didn't know what the problem was. You know what I mean? I didn't see what I was doing as a problem. And, you know, fast forward a little bit more, I was working for myself, and I thought I had it going on. You know, I'm renting this house in Maryland. I got, you know, a few vehicles on the road, and I'm supposedly taking care of business. And, you know, I came down, and I got introduced to this guy, and he had some stuff that I had stayed away from for a little while, and got hooked up with him, and next thing you know, I'm on a binge. So I go on a good binge for about 4 days and hadn't been to sleep, hadn't communicated with anybody. They're wondering where I'm at, what's going on, and I'm trying to sleep it off in my room. And my daughter, they needed me to watch my daughter. And her grandmother had brought her over that morning. And, you know, I came to the door, black eyes, groggy. And I remember bringing my daughter into the bedroom, and I'm like, just lay here with Daddy. Daddy does not feel well. And you know, I went to sleep, she stayed awake. And what happened next was the landlord called, which happened to be friends of the family. And she's 18 months old, maybe a little bit older at this time. She's talking really good for her age, and she has a conversation with him. She said, "Daddy won't wake up. He won't sleep. He won't wake up." And, you know, then they sent people over and got my daughter. And, you know, I remember her mother came by, and I was really feeling good about myself at this point, you know. And I'm standing out in the driveway, and I don't know, I'm probably about 150 pounds at this point. And I remember she pulls up, and I'm like, "I just don't know what the problem is. I don't know what the problem is." She looked me square in the face and told me, "You're an alcoholic and you're an addict." And I'm like shaking my head like, "That can't be the problem, you know." So anyway, I ended up in my first treatment center after that. It wasn't long after that. And I remember I was in that treatment center, and man, I wanted to be sober. And, you know, I wanted to save everybody too. I'm going to tell you that much. You know, I was, I think I was 22 and a half at the time. And, yeah, because it was Christmas time. You know, I always seem to have this thing of during, you know, if I look back at the pattern of how things went, I had this pattern of getting in some kind of trouble or needing my dad right on his birthday. You know what I mean? And my first detox center, I wound up on my dad's birthday. I'm like, "Dad, I need you to drive me to detox." And he's like, and we're going there, and I'm like, didn't have, you know, anything. I'm like, "Man, we got to stop by the store, man. There ain't no point in going into a detox unit unless you're loaded." So I remember being in that Sheets bathroom and taking some Old English beer, guzzling them down in the stall, you know, because I had enough guests. Well, I knew they weren't going to let me drink in the car, so I had to drink it in there. And, you know, I go in there, I go to treatment, and I wanted to be sober. And I met a lot of people, well, some of the people that are sitting in here tonight, you know, those people that keep coming back, you know what I mean, to show a guy like me this thing works. You know, that's powerful stuff right there, for real. You know, they welcome me with open arms when I come out of treatment. And I decided that I'm just going to go to the treatment center meeting every night. That's where I'm going to get sober, is the treatment center meeting. And wasn't trying to hang out with nobody in sobriety, you know what I mean? I just wanted to go to a meeting because that's what y'all told me to do, just go to meetings, you know what I mean? And that lasted for about 3-4 months, you know, until I got uncomfortable again. And opportunity presented itself, and next thing you know, I was off to the races again. And so anyway, through my story, it goes, I'm in and out of the rooms. I mean, this is how it went. I switched one addiction for the other. A lot of times when I was doing one, I wasn't doing the other. And then there were some times where I was doing it all at one time. I mean, that's how it went. And there was a lot of God events that were going on in those moments that I just did not see that way. You know, a lot of things that were happening, and God was sticking his hand out, and he was trying to pull me in, and I just didn't see it that way. You know, there was a time when there was somebody that was, we were partying together in my apartment, and next thing you know, they're dying in my apartment, you know, just to put it that way. And, you know, I remember, this is how sick I was. This person is dying, and people are trying to save her life, and I've got to run to the other room to do up all the evidence that I have. Not get rid of it, to do it up, you know, because I pay for that stuff. You know what I mean? And, man, I was a sick puppy, man. I mean, a lot of stuff that makes sense today damn sure didn't make sense back then, and stuff that made sense back then sure don't make sense today. But so anyway, there was a lot of opportunities to get sober. I just could never grasp the concept, you know, that the first drink gets me drunk. You know, I remember coming in here and hearing that and be like, "What are y'all talking about? The first drink gets you drunk." I mean, that's just crazy. But anyway, I ended up getting in trouble with the law this was the beginning of the end for my struggle. And I got arrested, rescued, and I had been dealing with them, you know, like little spouts here and there for destruction of property, or if I didn't get my way, I threw a fit kind of deal, but never been caught for anything as far as a felony wise. And, you know, I remember coming in and y'all talking about, there was guys in here that were talking about, I'm a this felon, I'm a that. And I said, well, that ain't never happened to me, and it ain't going to happen to me. And each time I went back out, it just kept getting worse. You know what I mean? Like, I picked up different habits, and I things started to go downhill a little bit faster. And I got in trouble with the law. I remember I went to meet with my first probation officer. They had given me a chance to not have a felony on my record. It's called a first offender's plea. And I went before my probation officer after getting out of jail, which I lasted about an hour out of jail before I was getting loaded again. And I had to see my probation officer the next day. And I remember going in to see him, and he said, well, it's time for a UA. And I said, well, there's no need in that. I'm dirty. He said, well, you just was in jail. What do you mean? And I said, well, I'm an addict. You know, it was like a crutch, an excuse. And he didn't see it that way. He said, well, let's talk about some treatment. And my disease said, oh, no. We ain't having none. We've been there. We don't need to go back. We know what they're talking about. And, you know, once the party gets going, I mean, once I put something in me after I've stopped, once I put something in me, my whole personality changes, my whole mental well-being changes. I mean, I get locked and loaded on a one-track mind. You know, it's where's it at and how can I get more? I mean, that's just where it's progressed for me. And, you know, the great obsession. So anyway, I went on the run for 9 months and they finally caught me. And, you know, then I got introduced to my sponsor. He was working at the parole board at the time. And, you know, long story short, it had to be a few more occurrences with the law for me to, you know, figure out that this is where this is going. And I remember I wound up in my final treatment center, which was back in January of 2015. It was my second trip through the Boxwood. I went to the old one, went to the new one. I got mixed reviews on both if you want to see me after the meeting. I see a few workers in here. I don't want to. No, but anyway, so I remember all the stuff that I was hearing for years. All the stuff I was hearing for years was that I kind of picked up along the way that would still be in the back of my mind at times when I was doing wrong. And I remember, man, you know, right there before, at the end, you know, I had got news that I had another baby on the way. I wasn't living right. I had already been down that avenue. I knew where it was going to end up. You know, I felt about this big, you know. I was definitely at this point less than. You know, my sponsor always talks about, you know, if you get honest with yourself, you look at certain situations, Daryl, you was either better than or less than. You was never just part of the crowd. And, you know, I look back on my life, and that was a lot of situations, you know. Well, anyway, I was less than at this point, and it came to the point where I couldn't get enough drugs or alcohol in me to get that stuff to go away. I mean, it was a constant nagging in my mind. It was a mind grind all the time. I lived in paranoia. I lived in fear to the max. So anyway, I wound up in this treatment center, and I was facing new legal issues. I was already on probation. I had a new baby coming into the world in a few months. I didn't know how any of this was going to end up. You know what I mean? And I remember being in that treatment center, and my counsel in there helped me a lot. The workers in there helped me a lot. I wanted to be there. And I remember being in there, and I finally, that was the moment when I finally accepted and took that first step. I took a good, honest look at Daryl, what was going on in his life, and came to the realization that any way that I try this deal, it always ends up the same. That once I start, I can't stop. You know, I'm powerless. I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless, over my addiction as a whole. And, I was looking back at certain situations, I was too smart to realize that it was a drink that always got me. I'm not an alcoholic, though. You know? I was in a situation, I'm like, oh, yeah, I can go hang out over there, man. They're just drinking. You know? And the next thing you know, I'm sitting there watching them. And I'm like, nah, I'm not doing it tonight. Not tonight. Just give me one. You know? And I just started the cycle over again. You know, but I was a smart guy. You know, it just took a while to figure it out. But, so anyway, I accepted that first step in that treatment center, and something in me started to change. And man, when that obsession and that constant nagging of wanting something to feel different in that sense as far as drugs or alcohol was lifted, man, that was one of the greatest gifts I ever received. Because I can remember going to bed thinking about it and waking up thinking about it. It was my first thought. You know, I was reaching for it. And when I was in there and I actually first started to be able to sleep and then to be able to wake up, and I noticed that my thoughts were starting to change, and that was not in my thoughts. And so then life got in my thoughts. And started to realize what was really going on, that I got a whole lot to deal with here. And how am I going to deal with it? And I realized I didn't have to deal with it alone. I was homeless. And needless to say, my parents didn't want nothing to do with me anymore. They couldn't trust me. It got to the point where I couldn't even trust myself. You know. So anyway, I remember I was calling up Dad, please just let me come home. I swear it's going to be different. And he stuck to his guns and said, no, it ain't going to be like that. You can get it from the rough. That's pretty much what he told me. And, remember I was boo-hooing and I was this and that. And I said, so what can I do, man? What can I do? And somebody as simple as this told me, pray about it. And I said, all right, well, I'm going to try. You know, because I always had a belief in God, but I just didn't think he cared enough about me. You know, he was too busy giving other people breaks and blessings and all this stuff, you know. He wasn't worried about me. And I remember I prayed about it. And, you know, there were some people working behind the scenes. And I remember I was in there, and this guy walks in 2 days later. You know, 2 days before I'm getting out of the treatment center, and said, heard you're looking for a place to stay. Come see me when you get out of here. And that was one of them God moments where it started to click. You know, the ball started rolling in his favor of me looking, you know, for him, for help from him. And I'll never forget that, man. I swear I'll never forget that. So anyway, that's when life started to change. I remember I moved in with this gentleman, and he used to have these sayings with him. And one of them was, you can learn a lot by watching somebody. And I started to pay attention. I really did. Something inside me woke up and wanted to be sober and wanted to learn how to be sober, wanted to learn how to live sober. And, I remember watching this guy getting down on his knees at nighttime. I remember watching him wake up with a smile on his face. You know what I mean? Like, I was a sad, fearful little kid. And, I realized I wanted to be like that guy. So what do I got to do? And he told me, just be willing to change. This is exactly what he told me. Be willing to change. And I remember going over to my sponsor's house, and, you know, we were having a little get-together, drinking some coffee, and this was nighttime, and I'm boo-hooing, and, you know, I'm talking about, what am I going to do? I got, you know, this stuff going on, and he was sitting there, and I remember looking at him, and he had his legs crossed, he had a big grin on his face, and he had his cup of coffee, and he's just sitting there smiling at me, and he said, it's all going to work out, just don't drink. And, he said, just stay sober. I promise you it's going to work out in your favor. I'm like, well, I don't know how this is going to work. And so anyway, that was when I started to go to more meetings. In my first year, I don't think I missed a meeting. And anyway, that was when I first started to learn how to do self-examination. Take a look at Daryl. What is Daryl doing? I remember taking a look at that second step and then talking about restoring me to sanity. And I was so sick, I really didn't think I was that insane, you know what I mean? And then I started, staying sober for a few days at a time. And I'm looking around and I'm noticing I'm doing some of the same stuff and I'm thinking it's going to be different. And it had nothing to do with drinking or drugging. And there were some things I really had to pray hard about. And slowly but surely, God told me one time, it was more than one time, he told me, he said, to change your thought, you got to change your action. And I was like, what does that mean? And he said, don't do what you're thinking about doing, do the opposite. And, it was like, I always wondered why my bills were late or why I didn't want to pay them at all. You know what I mean? Like, I was that kind of guy. Like, I would establish things, and then I wouldn't want to pay for them. And I noticed that my thoughts started to change when I started to just go ahead and pay it. Maybe gripe about it, whatever. But go ahead and pay it. And then I started to think, well, man, you know what I mean? This ain't so bad. You know, this is what normal people were doing. You know what I mean? But, like, seriously, I was not that grown up at all when I got here, man. Like, it's taken a long time, day in and day out of me realizing that. Like, I'm still a little kid, man. I'm a little kid. But anyway, so time goes on. There were some things I remember that changed my perspective on things. I remember when my perspective on things started to change was when my son was born. I remember being in the hospital, and the girl that I was with at the time, my son's mother, she had another little boy, right? And I could not be around both of them at the same time because his father, knew who I was, and he took certain steps to keep me out of his son's life. And I used to throw a fit about that. And I remember when I left that hospital, because he was coming to see his brother for the first time. And, later on that day, I was looking back at my day, and I was, thinking about my thoughts and all this and that. And I said, wow, I wasn't cussing him out. You know what I mean? Because I used to think it's that little bastard's fault. Excuse me, but that's the way I thought. You know what I mean? Like, he's the one keeping me from this. And then it was finally, I took a look at it. It was like, you've been doing this the whole time. You know what I mean? All your actions are influencing everything around you. And I also got introduced to how to have fun in sobriety. I remember getting sober and being like, what is there to do? What am I going to do with all this free time? And ain't much free time anymore. I do know that ever since life came along. But anyway, I remember first time I got to go to sessions, I was hearing all about it, and I'm like, well, okay, I'll check it out. So I go down there to sessions, man, and I remember being out there, and I'm on the boardwalk, and like, I'm trying to be comfortable within Daryl, but I don't have it at all. And, I'm watching these people play volleyball, and I remember having a full-on conversation with Daryl. You ought to go over there and ask them to play volleyball. Nah, they don't want you to play volleyball with them. You probably ain't good enough to play volleyball with them. And I don't know if anybody else has ever had any conversations like that with themselves. Maybe I'm just crazy. But, I remember I was with the gentleman that brought me into his home. And, I was telling him about what was going on, and he said, they ain't going to bite you, and they probably ain't going to say no. Just go on over there and ask them. And it's not that big of a deal. And I was like, wanted to tell him, man, you don't understand, man. Like, I've been sitting here for 15 minutes trying to figure out why they don't want me to play volleyball with them. And, you know, it just, it's the longer I think about something, the worse off it gets, it seems to be. You know what I mean? And I'm just wired with negative polarity, I guess. And so anyway, I asked them, and they said, yeah, come on in and welcome me with open arms, just like at a meeting. You know, and I started experiencing some fellowship outside of being around Culpeper and seeing how big this thing really is, you know. And, you know, there's a lot of things that I've started to learn to do in sobriety. And one of the greatest gifts that I've also received was to be able to cry those tears of gratitude, man. You know, when I get that feeling deep down in here, that everything is okay and it's just the way it's supposed to be, man, and those tears come out and I realize that God is doing for me what I could not do for myself, how much my life has changed, man, it's just an amazing feeling. And I remember, you know, I was in and out of my daughter's life, and, you know, I started to build a relationship back with her, and I did it again, you know, and then I got sober. And then I'm trying to prove to her that this is what I want to do. And she's over, and her mom's trying to trust me and everything else. And she's over at the house, and she throws a fit, man. You know, it's not like her. And she slams the door. I want to sleep with Grandma and all this stuff. I'm like, well, at home you sleep in your own bed. Here you have your own bed. I was, you know, over at my parents' house. And, you know, so something just told me on the inside to go in there and talk to her, be a father. You know, and so I walked in there and I sat down and I talked to her, and she was beating around the bush. So I'm playing with her and I'm trying to get it out of her. And I remember this is how it went. She teared up on me. I mean, she's got big, beautiful eyes, and these tears just started flooding down her face and she couldn't get it out. And she said, Daddy, I'm scared. And I said, well, what are you scared of? She said, I'm scared you might do it again and you're going to die. And at that moment in time, I didn't know what to say. All I could do was pray. And about 15 seconds later, what came to me was, I'm scared too, honey. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. And she hugged me and I hugged her, man. It was just one of those moments, you know. And it was one of those moments when I realized how much I affected everybody around me in my addiction and my alcoholism. And you know, there was quite a few instances like that. And you know, I've had to learn through staying sober that, you know, our primary purpose is to stay sober first and then help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I used to think it was the other way around because, you know, I got 3 days, I'm fresh out the treatment center, that I need to round everybody up and we're going to a meeting kind of deal. And it didn't work like that. You know, they definitely got me drunk before I got them sober. There's been so many things that have been taught to me here around the rooms and hanging out with sober people. How to have a relationship with God. You know, how to do self-examination by taking inventory. Learning to admit when I'm wrong. That was a big one. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there were some things that I had resentments towards that I really didn't think I had resentments towards. But come to find out, you know, a lot of my resentments, I'll be honest with you, I had a lot towards Daryl. And I had to forgive Daryl at some point. And I remember being in, one of the 7 detox units I wound up in. The guy was in there, and he was in the program, and I was telling him everything. I know, and I need to do this, and I need to do that, and I'm going to do this, and I'm talking about this, and talking about that. And he just looked at me, and he said, just stop. He said, man, you're insightfully constipated. I want to punch that guy right in the face, because first off, I didn't understand what he meant. You know what I mean? And come to find out, he was telling me that all the answers, you know, you see all what is going on and you're looking inside, but you're not willing to do a daggone thing about it. And, you know, they told me that this is a program of action, and I don't know if that scared me at first or what, is what kept me from not being able to be sober, or I just hadn't drank and drugged enough. You know, but I will say there was some amends that I didn't think I was going to be able to make, and it was a few months ago that, you know, it was a guy that took me in as like his own son at periods of my life when I was being a knucklehead with my family. I would go stay over there, and it ended up being a time when I was low in my drinking and drugging, and I stole from them, and, you know, they couldn't believe that I would do something like that. And I used to think, well, you shouldn't have left it out. You know what I mean? But anyway, I had some amends to make with that family, and, you know, this is just one of them. And that man passed away, and there was something in me that told me that you need to go. This is one of the things you need to do. And my head told me that, no, the family don't want to see you. Nobody wants to see you. What are you doing there? This and that, this and that, and... You know, my gut was telling me to go, and I went down there, and it was nothing like I thought it was going to be. I was welcomed with open arms, and they had heard what I've been doing in my life, and they were proud of me. And, you know, they told me that they were so glad because Gary thought so highly of me. Mm-hmm. And he was proud of you before he died, and I'm sure he's smiling down on you now. And, you know, not to make it all about me, but to be there and be a part of that whole deal. You know, and to face my fears once again, because that's a lot of things that hold me back in life, is being scared. But anyway, I've come to the end of this hour. I'm not going to hold this meeting hostage. So I just want to end with this, that, you know, I'm just very thankful for the guys that came around here and learned to live simply so I could simply live, to be honest with you. Because, you know, it's the ones that keep coming back that have learned not to be selfish and keep coming back and show a guy like me that this thing works, man. Because I came in here and I seen the same faces and I seen their lives getting better and mine getting worse. And it finally clicked that this could work for me. And so if you're new or if you're old, just keep coming back, man, because it's the best thing smoking. Thank you.